I also want to thank Ruth for inviting me to be a part of this, and mention that in this very room we have some really exemplar scholars in Latino research, Hortensia among them, Aida, Ruth over there, and there are probably others. So my topic is really to talk about who's in this room and how we're preparing the future leadership of this country to take on the challenges of disparities. And we are essentially, as I said in my last session, some of you might have been in the last session, so I'm going to fast forward that part and get to the other piece. But you know, if we look at the numbers and the increasing diversity of this country and where we'll be in less than 20 years from now, where we are today, where you know half of the children born in this country being of color, and the kind of dire situation in which we have very few Latinos in higher education who are teaching in faculty, who are in leadership positions. We have a few Latinos in health policy leadership positions. If you ever have gone to the National Health Policy Forum meeting in D.C., you could probably count them in less than one hand. And so when it comes to leadership and scholar activism, which I think is a kind of research that we do, who come from the communities whose very family members are struggling with these issues, have that frame of scholar activism. It's the doing and taking the knowledge to activate change. We need more of that. And so I'm not going to tell you who we are, because if you don't know who we are, who knows? If you know where we are, raise your hand. Anybody know Robert Wood Johnson Foundation? So if you don't know who we are, ask those people, and they will tell you. You know, we've done a lot of work in this area of health equity. I'm just fast-forwarding to get to the part around diversity in the professoriate. And all of this data is available. I mean, there's no, you know, mystery here. The more money you have in this country, the better health you have. That's the kind of system that we created intentionally. You know, we are the only civilized country in the planet that bases their health system on employment. Right, and so you know it's a structural inequality that's built into the system that you have to go through your employer to access care, the odds of in this country of actually getting a college degree by the time you get to a sophomore year, based on all the studies, including this by the Commission for a Healthy America, is if your parents have a high school education, the likelihood that you'll get a college degree is about 6%. Right, compared to if you have a college degree, your children have a 73% chance of getting a college degree. Where do you think most Latinos reside? Right, in that smaller percentage. My parents had second and third grade educations. I mean, I had a 6% chance of actually getting a college degree. I didn't know anyone in my community who had a college degree. And, you know, it was not for the grace of God and Mrs. Garces in 10th grade who said, you know, you're kind of smart, you should go to college. So, you know, thank you. Mrs. Garces. Yeah. You know, and I want to, you know, in the last session, someone raised a very important question. What do you say to those people who are really struggling to make a difference? And every day it's that continued kind of, you know, loom and doom about the reality that, you know, we think about the, you know, the 47%, you think about the 1%, you think about what the perspective of those in power and money of are the other half of the country. You know, it's cause for worry, right? But at the same time, we're all here because we have a purpose, right? And that's the purpose that only we can fulfill. And so I'm here to kind of leave you, although I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the bad news, I hope to give you some inspiration about what some of us are doing. In the other session, we also talked about this, you know, the issue of migration and migration patterns and how, you know, if you look at the professoriate in the United States and you look at who is the Latino professor and who is the African-American professor, and you find out that they're more likely to come from outside of the United States. And we're not growing Latino scholars from the U.S., we're importing them. You know, so that they can take on leadership positions and represent the brown face in the department. Okay, these are issues that are really sensitive but important topics to address. I think it's important to create pathways for everyone who wants to come, but not at the disenfranchisement of those who were born and raised in this country, who grew up experiencing the policies and the structural racism that we have. So, you know, I think these are delicate but important conversations because, as I said in the last session, might have come here as an MD from Colombia. By the time you have grandchildren, they will wake up in a racist society that sees them as Latino. Okay, so you need to be aware of the implications of that kind of asymmetry, right? I mentioned this in the last session, but it's worth repeating, this whole point of intergenerational kind of issues and kind of how the worse, the more, the longer, there's a toxicity in the air in this country. So if you are not born here, you have this Hispanic paradox of good health, but just stay a generation and you'll catch up to the rest of us who were born here. You know, if you want the bad smoking habits and the exposure to toxins in the environment and mental health and depression and all those things, you know, let's talk in 20 years. Your children and your children's children will have that access to inequity. So the intergenerational issue and the fact that regardless of immigrant background, black, Latino, or Asian, two and three generations down the road, you're more likely to have these disparities. I point this out because, you know, how many times, I even heard this in the last session, we'd love to do American Indians, but they're just too small a group. You know, and no one questions that we have this bias toward quantitative research. Where's the value of quality? If you have 12 Indians and they're all experiencing some kind of health crisis, is that not enough qualitative information to mobilize some action? Right? So this over-reliance on statistical significance. And I believe in research. I have a PhD, you know, from a pretty good school and, you know, been taught well. But I also believe there's an unspoken story about that bias and how that perpetuates kind of the bucket of, you know, Latinos, the bucket of Asians, you know, the buckets of blacks, even blacks. I mean, they're as a people, you see kind of the there's more diversity among blacks than there is diversity between blacks and Latinos. I mean, you could really the differences are greater within race and ethnicity than they are between. This is some of the data I showed before. So I want to get to this issue of underrepresentation in colleges and universities. So we're looking at a time in which more than half the children in this country are brown or black, but less than 11% of our faculty are of color. Less than 2.7% of faculty, full professors, associate professors, assistant professors, and instructors in a minority are in higher education. 2.7% we're 15% of the population now, will be 30% in less than 20 years. Okay, so where's the leadership? Where are the role models? Any of these professors here today, Ruth and Hortensia and Aida, can tell you that when they were on their campuses, every Latino student on that campus knew who they were. And they were responsible for their entire careers. Everybody who needed a mentor went to see Dr. Amaro, Dr. Zambrano, and Dr. Ghiacello. And so it's really important that we create a system where there's more availability, and then ask them how many of them got tenure because they were good mentors. No, they got tenure because they were publishing and they had research. So, and research, to get tenure, you have to have research. And to get research, you need dollars. And who's getting dollars? And I shared in the prior study that the NIH looked at their data, who was applying, and they found out that for African Americans, we're 30% less likely than other groups to get an NIH grant, everything else being equal. But what was surprising to me is if they didn't find that same difference between Latinos and whites. But here's the thing that they didn't report in that article, and I had a conversation with Donna Ginther about that. But tell me who was among those Latinos who are getting grants. So in this country, if you took all the Latinos, about 40% are foreign-born. And that some people say it's an underestimation, but let's say 40%. If you looked at the Latinos who received grants, almost 60% of them were foreign-born. That's a 20-point difference, and so that's significant. You know, you want to understand why is it that foreign-born trained scholars are more likely to get NIH grants than U.S.-trained, right? So, you know, this is the whole issue of, you know, segregation. And segregation is as diverse as you think New York is. About 83% of the population would have to move in order to really live in a diverse and integrated society. There's this thing called the dissimilarity index that shows what percent of the population would have to move for there to be equity. It's like that we would go home and sleep in the neighborhoods that look like the neighborhoods we work in, but it's not true. Most of the country is segregated. Segregation has consequences. It has consequences for access to income, jobs, education quality, hospital quality of care, access to care. All of that is impacted by segregation. So, but you know, segregation was a written U.S. policy, written into the Federal Housing Authority. Okay, I have 3 minutes. Goodbye. All right. So. All right. We could have a longer conversation. I'm available for drinks later. I just want to talk really briefly in these last 2 minutes about New Connections, which is a program that I started with some colleagues at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to support historically underrepresented scholars because of that sense of isolation. We have some people here who've been part of this program. I know some of you. Hello. And as a result of this, you know, this was started out as a program for like a grant making. We did 12 grants a year. And what we found, and we were the first national program from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to do this, is that people were applying for the program not because they wanted the money, but because they want to be part of a network of other scholars like them. And so what we did for the first time in the foundation's history is we looked at everybody that was turned down, and we said, would you like to come to the meeting? And we invited those folks to a meeting. Today we have a network of 1,200 scholars from all over the country, all minority, and some whites who are first-generation college graduates. And it's important to note that if you're a first-generation college graduate, irrespective of race, the battle is steep. Right? If you have parents who are education, which I just told you, you're not gonna have a problem. But if your parents are, you know, underemployed or unemployed, even if you're white, the chances of you getting to college are lower. Right? This is our program. We have a great time because, you know, there's something liberating about walking into a room and not being the only person of color. Right? Especially if you're a scholar, because no one questions you whether you got that degree because of affirmative action. No one has this haze of like, is she really qualified or whatever? Yeah, well, you go in and there's a sense of freedom and liberation. So I wanna close with, you know, some, you know, talk a little bit about healing. Because as hard as you work and as important as these issues are and as passionate as you are about this issue, it's important to reflect on healing and how we as a people need to support each other. You know, you can be a lone cowboy or a lone cowgirl and write your paper and publication, but you will suffer the consequences. It's important to have partnerships and co-authorships, and you get 3 other people to write with you. You get 4 publications a year instead of 1. You could be first author on 1, second, third, fourth, and others. And it matters to have these collaborations. It also matters with your own thinking so that you can do it in a free space. We had a conference in April. It was a small grant. We thought, you know, let's bring some Latina research together. Thanks to a few folks getting together, and we have put this conference together, and we thought we would get about 50 Latina researchers, and we got almost 300 scholars, Latinas from all over the country coming to this conference from Iowa, Idaho, Nebraska. There are Latina researchers in almost every state who are in their struggle trying to make a difference. And so I just want to, you know, give a shout out to those Latina scholars who are here because there's a space for you. And I'll end just saying, you know, this is my nephew. His name is SJ, and he has a hoodie on. I want to encourage you that when you talk about your research and your work, that you talk beyond the what you do and the how you do it. And yes, you know, your background in terms of your experience, your education is important. But what inspires people is to hear why you do what you do, right? So Martin Luther King didn't say he had a plan, right? He had a dream. That inspires people. So talk about your dream and talk about the passion that you have that brings you to this work, and we will all be better for it.
I love your comments and your talk. Thank you very much. You know, I worry about the academia not being representative, and I know that you know this, but it bears really pushing hard on the fact that we don't have enough success in Head Start programs for Latinos. Mm-hmm. You know, our Latino children are usually not in daycare. They're mm-hmm. with someone, a neighbor or a family or something. They don't have the stimulation that's required. Mm-hmm. And I come from Austin, Texas, where people talk about, you know, the problem of immigrants, and it's like, you know, the problem is all our problem. I'm mm-hmm. a lesbian, don't have children, but I care so much about kids and yes. their education because it's the only way we're going to make progress.
Right.
So we all have to push and really hard because that representation is not going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think there's a fine balance between being angry and being adamant and being arrogant, and I like your sense of humor. I think you do that very well.